Who's been here all day? Surely not.
Oh, I think they've earned the right to demand some answers then to questions.
I think you have. No,
sorry?
We don't swap chairs, no. Hey, don't tread on my specs. Hold on, I'm coming back in.
How did you know that rule? You're supposed to swap chairs. Where did that come from? Right.
Forget about the furniture, love. It's too late. Now, one of the things that really surprised me about what you were talking about earlier, and I think it's one of the woeful aspects of the scientific community, is that psychologists can forget completely that well over 100 years ago, Freud set up his couch, and the inner life was so important, and that psychology should have moved so far away from psychoanalysis is a real tragedy, because without the inner life, there really isn't much point having an outer life, I don't think. I mean, I think the unexamined life is not worth living. It's probably quite a good maxim. And it does distress me that there really is a division between a certain kind of scientist. I don't mean the kind like Dan Glaser, you know, who was in this morning, you know, who is very engaged with a wider community of thought, but with what it seems to me to be quite a reductive view, where exactly, you know, I think the word you used was flaky, where there's a certain kind of scientific approach that thinks, you know, anything that's about the inside, which can't be measured empirically, and it's very, you know, the way psychologists always want to measure everything, is really something that either isn't the domain of science, and therefore the subtext isn't really a domain which is worth spending that much time. It's kind of decorative, whereas, of course, I think it's central, and that if you don't have an active inner life, which I believe is one of the things that stops you aging badly and keeps you alive, allows you to learn new things, to be interested, to be somebody who's contributing as well as receiving, without all of that, which is the inner life, is a good description of it. What's the point? I mean, we might as well all go into the cryonics department now, it seems to me. You know, there is one. If you get the railway train from Oxford to London, you go past this really sinister shed that says Thames Cryonics. And I always think it's because the railway is so slow and everybody sort of died of waiting trying to get from Oxford to London, and then they just get shoveled into the cryonics shed.
Do you actually know what happens in there?
No, it's blue. It looks like just one of those big rent-a-shed things, and it was only when the train was outside. It's just in between Didcot and Reading, and it says on it Thames Cryonics. And you always go past it painfully slowly. So I reckon there's a lot of passengers in there, people who've gone missing. You know, there's missing persons list. I think they're in there. But
if anyone, you can get
you can email me about
RH Wi-Fi, and if anyone can get online while we're here, it would be nice to know what the Thames Cryonics.
Find out about Thames Cryonics. Who they're freezing? It's probably your beloved pet. But you know, from where I'm sitting, for me, everything is about the inner life, and it's about that place where you go, which completely makes meaning of the outer life, makes sense of it, revitalizes it, is part of it. So I'm coming to you from this situation and just saying, surely it matters enormously, and that's the place we want to be.
It definitely, I think you would have appreciated that I was going to agree that it matters. But it's kind of touching that you think that psychologists should be let loose on it.
Are there any here? Hands up if you're a psychologist.
I'm not worried about my enemy count. Yeah. I think it's a question of territories. On the one hand, there is a legitimate enterprise of trying to measure stuff. I mean, we've made some horrible
Thames Cryonics. Right, here we go, boys and girls.
Fantastic.
What is it?
One second. Thames Cryonics. I can't even see that talking about. I need a chip in my eye or glasses. What does it do? Okay. Thames Cryogenics Limited are a world leader in the manufacture, installation and servicing of cryogenic storage and distribution equipment. Whether you're looking for just liquid nitrogen piping.
Oh! Right.
Oxygen depletion monitoring systems are a complete package, including bulk tanks and dual filling stations. Thames Cryonics have a solution for you. I don't believe it. I'm with Jeanette. I think it's shifty.
Oh, I think it's shifty. Liquid
nitrogen.
Just
nitrogen,
So now you know we've uncovered something tonight. Twilight Zone. What were you saying?
There is a legitimate exercise in trying to measure mental function, just because some things will be interesting to describe how brain cells do stuff. I think that's legitimate. We have made some horrendous mistakes, if you think of some of the IQ mistakes we made, especially with soldier populations, and IQ mistakes we've made with different racial populations over the years. So whether we're measuring the right thing or not, I don't know. But there is this...
A lot of those tests have been deeply discredited, haven't they? Racist and sexist, the whole business.
Yeah. The question is, how far do we take the legitimate reductionist exercise? Mm-hmm. And I think there's always a legitimate component to a reductionist program. And what do we do when that starts to interface with the real world and with our inner life? And I've tried to do this in my work in the past few years, and I can tell you, the inner life's awfully complicated.
I know that, love.
And the truth is that we're often not equipped in our conceptual thinking or our measurements to approach real inner states. And just now, in the past few years, we've started to be able to examine brain states during hypnosis and during meditation. And I think these things are really extremely valuable. They just enrich our understanding at one particular level.
Well, the Dalai Lama's cooperated with quite a lot of that, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Which have been, I don't know if you've read any of those books, they're really fascinating that he's had his brain measured and scanned while he's been in deep meditative states. Mm. And what goes on there is really extraordinary. Yeah. But we could all have it if we did, if we meditated since we were two.
Yeah. And it is true that these things change things like your pain thresholds, your memory, your concentration, all sorts of things. The question, I suppose, is how far psychologists should go, and most psychologists should be stopped very, very soon before they get anywhere near the inner life.
Which is probably best understood anyway, for probably by the usual routes. I mean, if I break my leg, I go to a doctor, but if I break my heart, I go to the poets.
I really wouldn't disagree. You need another scientist to disagree with this.
No, it's good. I mean, it's late at night, isn't it? We don't want a bum fight. But I think it is the way, obviously, when we look at, if we go to pictures, we listen to music, we read poetry, we go to fiction, we are finding a map. It is a map of an inner state, not only of the inner state of the person or who made that particular thing, but strangely, a map that becomes a root of our own inner space, our own condition, which then can be followed. Mm. And one of the strange things, I think, about coming to a really important piece of work is, it's not only, it takes you to the place, a new place, but it is also the place that it takes you. So there's a paradox there. So it becomes the thing that enriches your life through its own medium, and it then becomes part of you. So it has a kind of nano effect on you, I think. So there's this tiny thing then lodged in there, which is yours. It's no longer just it, it's you as well. And I love that crossover. And I mean, obviously you're a good scientist, not a bad scientist. But
I'm glad it's obvious.
It's very obvious. And we're talking to Dan this morning about all of that, and he was saying, we're talking about mind and brain, and I said, look, I think mind is an unbounded condition, which he liked, but he said if there's somebody else sitting here, they'd be saying to you, there's no such thing as mind, that's a narrative we have to use until we know enough about brain to get rid of mind, which of course is repellent to me. You know, I'm keeping my mind.
I think sometimes I think it's healthy to you're keeping it temporarily. It's not within your gift.
Oh no, I'm having
it's healthy to keep the domains separate sometimes. I think one of the things that I find most irritating is when you get scientists on the TV or on the radio, and they're discussing music or they're discussing art or they're discussing literature, and they say, well, listening to that as a scientist, and I can't think of anything worse to do when I put Miles Davis on my CD player of listening to him as a scientist. You know, it's a really bad idea. Mm. And I think that the domains of experience and the domains of explanation are not completely separate, but it's very, very difficult to interface the two. And I think a lot of scientists should be kept well clear of it. A colleague of mine did an interview with a scientific magazine recently, and one of the two standard questions they get asked is, what do you think is the next big thing in your field? And the other question is, what's your biggest mistake? And every single scientist, to a man and woman, says, well, I don't think I've made a really big mistake yet. And I think, what a dull life they must have been leading if they're striving to explain something and they haven't made any mistakes. My guess is that most of what you write ends up in the bin It's mistakes.
In the wood-burning stove.
Yeah.
That's why I live in the country.
And his answer to the question about what's the next big thing in your scientific discipline, which is my scientific discipline, is he said, well, unlike in the arts, in which most of the great work has already gone before us, the best is still... I thought you'd like it. The best is yet to come in science. And I thought... And that night, I went to watch listen to the Kronos Quartet with Wu Man playing ghost opera. And I went on my own, and I'm so glad I did, because it tore me up. It absolutely tore me up. And I just thought, thank fuck they don't know it's all over for the arts. And I sometimes...
No, it is an astonishing view, that, because...
It's current. Well, it's recurrent. Yeah. It's recurrent, yeah.
Because where I stand, I look at science, and I think science, rightly, must be continually updating itself, and you have to throw out your theories. Mm. You often have to reconfigure everything and begin again and say, no, that was just completely wrong. Whereas the strange thing about the arts, all of them, is that they live in a perpetual present, and in fact the new work does not update the old work, nor does it render it redundant.
No, he had this
idea
that the sciences were somehow progressive.
Yeah.
The arts were somehow progressive.
Yeah, and the whole thing, I think the continuous present that art exists in is actually very therapeutic, because, you know, it's back to this sense of time, that in fact art, by its nature, is this great connector across time, so that time itself then takes on a different meaning, so that you're no longer isolated on a little raft of time, us here now, but you're connected to this great strand of history, which is also the human imagination, human thought, human emotion. Yes. And that makes me feel that... It's not that it's a consolation, but it makes me feel both the sort of foolishness of time as we normally conceive it, and also an exhilarating sense that I belong not just now, but in this great space of past and future. So it's all mine.
I have genuine sadness that science is often excluded from that view of time, that view of history. And I've had a very lucky career in that I've managed to not have a lot of teaching to do. That comes to an end soon. I've agreed to offer a lecture course. And the course that I've insisted on giving is on the history of science. For some reason, it's not delivered in most university departments, not just psychology departments. So the kids come in and they think that we're starting from here. And they don't read, if you like, the classics. You know, they don't read the older scientific papers, which give you a beautiful picture of the thought processes that had to go in with the equipment and the concepts that were available at the time. And I genuinely think it's something that we've lost, and it's the reason that I use this word twice already tonight. It's the reason why there's this humility missing from science, and why there's this whiff of righteousness in the air. I think we've lost this sense of our historical ridiculousness. I mean, some of the case studies I'm studying for my book of Lysenko, for example, killing hundreds of thousands of people by trying to prove that there was a Bolshevik genetics. People imagining that they'd discovered new parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, and when it was completely shown that they didn't exist, they just persisted with the belief out of national pride. People forging the Piltdown discoveries to prove that the first European in evolution would have been British. And somebody later on actually planted a cricket bat at the site as well to drive the point
home.
A cricket bat.
Marvelous.
Yeah. But we have all these normal stupidities in our history. I think we should glory in them, because they're part of what I think is really the normalcy of the day-to-day cognition, the day-to-day thinking, the day-to-day working of a scientist. And I'd like to think that at some point I could be sitting down and explaining the wave of history of science in exactly the same way as you've described that continuous presence of literature and the arts, because it's just another part of human culture. It's a fantastic one. It's one of my favourites.
And it is exhilarating. Yeah. But because what you can't do in the arts, because it gets you nowhere, is fake it. There's no point. You can't. It is the place where you can't lie. If you don't tell the truth, you can tell nothing. It is. We're talking this morning about this because I do believe that the poem or the painting, the piece of music, acts as a lie detector, both to the person who's making it and to the people who are receiving it. It is only a place where you can have authentic emotion or an authentic relationship. It's not a place. shut up a minute. It's not a place where you can simply come there and make it up. If you do, what happens is the thing doesn't last, and it really has no value in the wider culture. It's not a place where you can go there and think, I will now do something which is entirely self-conscious, just about me, and I'll just try and get away with something. It doesn't work. I mean, one of the great things is, of course, scientists get salaries and artists don't. So you'd never do it for the money. So there's really nothing in it for you anyway, if you fake it. And what it does do is give you this huge sense of humility, not only because you're comparing yourself to things which you know are very, very good, but also because what you're hoping to do is reach some emotional connection with other people which you believe to be valuable and genuine and have some resonance. So there's nothing in there which is valuable or worthwhile if you've cheated.
So you never... I frequently look at colleagues' papers and I think they've smoothed that data, or they've selected that data, or some of the they've selected the subjects. You never look at the work of another writer and think they're faking it?
No, not the good stuff. I mean, the real stuff. No, I don't. And I think also, you know, if you look at it with the search for language, the trying to find the way of talking about things which are shifting and often impossible to talk about. You know, I mean, what do we say when we're in a mess? We say, the word stuck in my throat. We say, I couldn't find the words. We say, I can't talk about it. We lose language. We go back to a pre-language state, so greater our emotions. And I think one of the things poets and writers are there to do is to give you the words, because when you get the words, then you're back in control, not in a reductive way, but in a way which allows you to express those feelings. So I think the search for that, the search for language which allows a linguistic equivalent of the emotional or imaginative experience, is what you're searching for. It's that calibration, which is intense and exact.
Do you think, your answer has to be partly yes, do you think that language is the best way of looking for that kind of equivalent of the emotions? And the reason I ask is that there's sometimes it seems to me that language makes us stupid and takes us away from the emotions that we might be experiencing. I'm sure most of you have read Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, and there's one of the many things that sticks in my mind from that book is the jam experiment. I don't know if you remember the jam experiment. And if there are people who make a living, if you think academics get away with it, tasting jam, and they might say that this is jam number A, jam B, jam A, jam B, jam C, and they rank them. And if you or I were to do this and just say, I like that one more than that one, more than that one, more than that one, we'd come out with pretty much the same rankings as the jam experts. But if you then ask us to write down what we think of each jam and then rank them, suddenly our rankings become random. And the reason seems to be is that we start to follow not our sensations, our feelings about, not that you have feelings about jam, their experiences of jam.
I do, because I make jam. I have quite intense feelings about jam.
We start to follow the words that we've made up about the jam, and that makes us, that skews our
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I think the seductions of narrative can be very dangerous, because we begin to tell ourselves a story. Quite often the stories we tell are false, which brings us back to psychoanalysis, because everybody who goes into psychoanalysis comes with a cover story. It's not the reason they're in the room. And part of the process is to unpeel that cover story and find out what's underneath. So it's getting beneath the fraudulent language into a place which is real and then can be reconstructed, hopefully, around a more truthful language. But I think certainly with the poem or the play or the piece of fiction, which is authentic, by which I mean that in the past it stood the test of time, or it's something that you come to and you find something real within it, hopefully that language is there to release you into a state which is the right one, and which is one where you can express more than you could before. And of course there has to be some touchstone in the self about that. The thing has to work, it has to happen. But I don't think it's necessarily the best way. I think music is an equally good way. I think that painting is an equally good way. I think it's often these things which simply allow an expansion of the self rather than a narrowing of the self. You know, the sort of sclerotic tendency to reduce everything and get caught and tight and rigid, which does happen as people get older. I think one of the ways to avoid that as you get older is to keep this open space which art offers, so that you're always testing self, emotion, reaction, experience, imagination against these fabulous things which allow you these wide landscapes, these other worlds, these different places.
I'd agree with it. And my guess is, and somebody was asking me about therapies, and I said get obsessed. My guess is that as you get older, these things become more rather than less important. And perhaps it's, just speaking of my own experience, perhaps it's because my day job is about articulating difficult things, either in words or numbers. I seldom turn to literature for any access to other feelings. It's music that does it. Yeah. I like the fact that what it is I'm getting to feel is inarticulable, and I try not to describe it. This is why I go to concerts on my own. I don't want somebody to say the second movement was really moving. I just want to be bloody moved by it.
Yeah. No, you know? I'm with you there. Yeah. I mean, I love the opera, and I prefer it if it's not in English.
Yeah.
Because
it's a place just
where you can be inside the
music.
Because
the words detract from
unless it was written in English, of course, which is different. But I think anything, that it is about that release, isn't it? And that coming towards something again in a different way, which is freeing for the self. And you'll know whether this is true as a scientist, but certainly I was interested in you playing the trumpet, because I thought to myself, I thought it's very important to keep teaching an aging dog new tricks, to go on challenging body and mind, so that the thing is slightly dangerous and slightly uncomfortable and slightly humiliating.
Because as
we get older, we keep doing what we're good at, don't we? And we tend not to learn new things. So I thought I'd better learn to ride a motorbike, because if I don't do it properly, I'll kill myself. And it will give me something to think about. It's been dreadful.
I did that one and nearly killed myself.
Yeah, so did I. It's a wonder we're both here tonight.
Literally.
Yeah, but it did. Yeah. I did find that it, for myself, it was incredibly stimulating.
Yeah. My
as
other
an activity.
Well, you're motivated to do it well. But my other obsession over the past few years has been rock climbing, and I took that up for an equally calculated reason. The trumpet was because I knew I could get better at it as time.
Did you read music before or not?
At school, I hadn't done anything for 30 years. I started from scratch, which when you're 42 years old is really a difficult thing to do, to go to somebody and stand there and go, you know, when you're used when you've spent 20 years getting some expertise in what you do, putting yourself at the bottom of the pile.
It is
very
good,
therapeutic.
Isn't it? It's that humiliation is very good.
But the other obsession, and maybe this is something that could be recommended to people who are worried about their aging brains, is to do something at which it's permissible to get slightly worse. So I've taken up rock climbing and at this age, I'm at a certain level at it, but it's graded. So as the years go by, I can kind of go down the grades instead of up the grades. It may be a little bit perverse, but it's a way of kind of having some kind of goal. And I like the idea of having the goal of getting slightly worse at something. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I was having supper last night, and
I'm succeeding.
Are you? Well, that's good. I might try rock climbing then. But I think it's, you know, the idea that it's inevitably, it's all going to be, it's all entropy, it's all going to be fighting the problems of gravity, it's all going to be downwards as we get older. I'd find that very negative and also unnecessary.
Downwards, or you end up going to places asking people if they can make things last longer. I don't know.
What, like cryogenics on the Thames Railway? Yeah. And I was sitting just at the table next to me last night, was Lucian Freud, and I was watching him partly eat his supper with his fingers. It was very nice. But I was actually very... I was interested in his gaze, which was extraordinary. And it was like having an ancient hawk sitting near you. Because I thought what that man's seeing isn't what I'm seeing. He's seeing things in spatial relationship. You know, it was interesting what you talked about earlier, that you described this as object, object, object.
Yeah.
Certainly not. And I think that's one of the extraordinary things probably about painters and painting, that they're not seeing it in that way as narrative or object. They're seeing it as spatial relationship. And as he was looking around, he was so intent, looking at everything, was absolute gaze, certainly not a blur. You know, one of the jokes in life is that we never look at anything, and we try not to look at things. And one of the few things you can actually look at is paintings, because you have to, because nothing else to do with them.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't put your cup of tea on them, you can't walk past them, you can't ignore them. It's not you, it's not your wife or your husband. Who are you? it's something that you actually have to look at. And really looking at something is very shocking, isn't it? Because you can no longer reduce it to the series of objects or a narrative. The spatial relationship then becomes a whole different kind of challenge, probably for the brain, I think, to see things in relationship rather than simply as separated objects, which I think the Western mind tends to do, separate everything out. And when you look at a painting, you tend to be bringing all of that back together, which is why it's kind of thrilling. And your brain goes, what? Yes, have another look.
One of the things
I've done for you, haven't I? Goodbye.
One of the things I did want to ask somebody about, and that you're the only person here with a microphone, so I can... is
power, isn't it?
What you think I love this, the long player idea. It's not merely romantic. It makes you really think about lots of aspects of time and space. But I did wonder if we are successful, and if Thames cryogenics is successful, and we come back here in 990 years' time, and we say that went well, didn't it? What the people in the audience would look like, you know, and apart from things like would flares be back, or you know, would a side passing still be okay? I'm wondering what you think people might be like in 990 years' time, because this is one of the things that it's one of the problems we have to solve is how we're going to live. To get back to what we were talking about. In the last session, how we're going to live with this massive, massive number of people, and the things that you and I are concerned about, like how a few brain cells might respond to something, or how you might articulate the feelings of people in some way. I use the phrase again, but somebody once described my work as it, and I thought it was a very good one. In a sense, intellectual masturbation, and we have to solve this problem of keeping people around and happy and fed and healthy for 990 years' time. So I just wondered whether you had any ideas other than microchips or creating life, which I thought was very smart.
Well, I think feeding them is an issue, but I think keeping them happy, it's probably best left to themselves. Mm. I think probably one of the reasons Americans find it so hard to be happy is that it's written in their constitution that they should pursue it. So you think, I should right to pursuit of happiness, I'm not happy. And then the whole thing just gets worse and worse. It's just better to leave it alone.
It doesn't
alone,
say
probably.
They have to, it just says no. They can do. Yeah. You know, they have the right
the
to do it.
The pursuit of. Yeah, but somehow I think they feel they should, and there's something desperately wrong with them if not, which is why they're so afraid of depression. You know, I think if you're not going to trigger a psychosis, it's probably better to let people go into a depression and find out exactly what's there. I mean, Freud used to say to people, which is great, and we always say, who are you angry at? He used to say, who are you depressed at? It's very interesting, because behind the anger is always the depression, and the depression tends to be, it's not a state or a condition. I think it's back to what you said earlier. It's this question of relationships. So instead of seeing things as static objects, you know, depression's a state, it's a condition. No, it's a relation too. And then I think our problems for the future are whether we can create relations to ourselves, other people, the planet, in a way which is meaningful, rather than seeing it all as a series of problems to be solved, you know, sort of tick, 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 we've done that. I'm not sure that would be the way forward. But if we survive, if we do, then I'm sure we'll be here. Because, you know, if you look back at the history of humanity, no matter how terrible, no matter how awful, no matter how dire the conditions, somebody wanted to paint a picture on a rock. Somebody wanted to make a song. Somebody wanted to make a musical instrument. Somebody wanted to tell a story. That seems to be hardwired into the human condition, which is why art's never a luxury or never an academic elitism. It's something which seems to have come spontaneously from us as human beings, from the beginning of any record of human beings, which I find very heartening. Mm, mm. So I guess somewhere we'll still be sitting here drawing something on this wall, and you'll be saying, is that an object or is it a spatial relation? And then we'll just cosh each other over the head, and then I'll eat him. That sounds likely. Who thinks we'll be here in 999 years?
Yeah, who does think we'll be here in it?
Where are the optimists in the audience?
These are the people with chairs and Thames cryogenics. You're so wrong.
I'd like to think so, even if we are very reduced, which we deserve, wouldn't we? Because we haven't behaved well. We have to face that. But there's still time to change it. And I'm not one of those people who think, you know, science is just fanciful in thinking it can create solutions. I think science probably can create many solutions for us, don't you?
Oh, I think there are some things that are purely the domain of science. I think feeding us will be the domain of science. It's probably... it's probably not high on your agenda, but I see very few ways around genetically modified foods in the future for the vast numbers of people that we're going to have to feed. I see very few ways around nuclear power or solar power.
Are you with James Lovelock on the nuclear option?
I'm not with anybody. This is one of the things that I think is really important to preserve, which is the independence of any scientific view from a political view. You know, whether I would like nuclear power or not is irrelevant. It's whether quantitatively you can find a way around it. So there are some things that I think are purely the domain of science, but there are others, and aging is one of them, where I think sometimes we're so excited about the prospect of what has become known as cognitive enhancement, you know, giving people drugs or chips in order to make their brains better, that we're missing out on the low-tech possibilities of helping people to use their brains in ways that will help you to have a naturally cognitively enhanced life.
I learn a poem every week, and I suggested this to some readers in my column in the Times. I learn a poem every week. Right. So I thought, I'll write this in my column, see if people... And so people started to take it up. And what was interesting was the responses coming back, especially when people are older. This lady who walks the dog every day, she said, this is terrible. I could only manage to learn four lines or five lines, so I was reduced to limericks. But then she became very popular at parties because she knew a lot of limericks.
I think that's an example of faking it.
Yeah, maybe it is, yeah. Yeah. But it improved her social life almost immediately, so you could try that. In fact, I'll do a science one for you. There was a young lady called Bright, travelled faster than the speed of light. She set off one day in a relative way and came home the previous night. So things like that improve your social standing. But then she began to learn longer ones, and she said to me, with absolute astonishment, she said, it works. And she'd stopped forgetting where she put her glasses. Yeah. She didn't go out anymore thinking, have I left the gas on? Yeah. So also probably, yeah. I think her longevity increased. She's no longer going to blow herself and the neighbours up. So, and all because of the power of poetry.
Somehow I don't see it getting on the NHS books as something that's going to... Although it's deliverable.
And it's deliverable. Cheap.
It comes in small packages.
Yeah. Quanta, like that.
Okay, I sense the beginnings of something here, yeah.
We might have to go into business somewhere in a shed on the Thames, probably, on the railway line.
Before we finish, is there anybody who's not been upstairs and listened to the long play yet? You've all been upstairs. Okay, that's all right, because I was going to say it is really not to be missed. Had you seen it before today?
No.
I'd heard about it, obviously, and discussed it, but it completely blew me away when
it's
I...
It's fabulous.
It really is very, very special. Yeah, and I hope it is here in 990 years' time.
I think it will, Archangel Michael Morris. I mean, this is a fantastic thing.
Will it rust if it's here in 990 years?
I don't know. You're the scientist. Will it rust?
Rust it must.
I've just had an outbuilding which is meant to rust. So instead of painting it every year, you spray it with water so it rusts more. I think this is marvellous. It's a special kind of water that sort of preserves the rust, and it's a sort of useful rust. Amazing what you people invent. So I'm sort of living in this high-tech rusty shed, but it's very nice. I think we're at the end, with or without the gong. Shall we all go and get a drink?
Bang the gong.
That's it.
Jeanette and I have controlled time.
We've controlled time.
Yeah.